Got to get all the clocks together here where I can see them. Keep from going overtime. My name is Rosemary, and I am an alcoholic. When I first came to AA, I didn't think I was. I like to talk about, you know, they suggest to us that we talk about what happened, or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But my story is one of denial, and I like to talk about what I thought it was like, what it was really, what happened, and what I found out it was really like, and what it's like now. Because that's how I came to AA. I thought I was a social drinker. I had no DUIs. I had no... nobody broke up with me because of my drinking. In fact, nobody that I can recall ever told me that I drank too much. I had never lost a job because of my drinking, at least not directly. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I was a social butterfly. I was painfully shy when I was younger. And I found that alcohol gave me that confidence that I needed to be social. And so whenever I went out, I always drank because that was the only way I was going to be able to talk to anyone. Now, I had learned through my parents that if you want to be part of the in crowd, 9 times out of 10, those are the worker bees. You think about going to church and the people that seem like that they are part of the church and they know everybody. They're the ones that are baking the cakes for the bake sale. They're the ones that are the ushers in the church or the altar guild or the parish council or something. They're the ones, and it's because they're doing the work that they get to know everybody. It's not because anybody likes them better than anyone else. So what I found for me was that when I got into an organization, and my mom reminded me that pretty much like as a parent, I was in the PTA because I was a parent, and that's what you do. You know, you're a part of the community, you do some volunteer work in the community. I had no problem, by the way, with AA service because I grew up on that idea, you know. So the bottom line is that for me to get comfortable in a social setting was to do two things. One is to be involved, and the other is to be drinking. So that's how I came out of my shell. And so at the time that I came to my first AA meeting, I was active in a singles group. And after my second event that I went to and was like glued to the wall because the natural Rosemary is a wallflower, I said, okay, I need to start doing things. So I started sponsoring Happy Hour. And basically all that involved was me putting my name in the newsletter for the group. If you're coming to Happy Hour, call Rosemary and I'll tell you where it's going to be, you know, or what time we're going to get there. Or I'll be your greeter, you know, that's somebody to touch base with when you first get there. So that meant I was at every Happy Hour. Then I started doing some other things. Well, next thing you know, they elected me to the board of directors, and that helped me really feel a part of things because if I go to your house for a party, I'm nervous and I'm shy. But if you come to my house, I'm the hostess and I'm going to greet everybody and be the, you know, all right out there. So that's where I became in the singles group, and I knew everybody in the group, and I was the greeter at the events, and you know, I was at home. We ended up, they put me on the board, and my first job on the board was activities director. Well, I am here to tell you that by the end of the first quarter that I was in that position, we had to put stuff on the calendar saying laundry night, because there was every other night of the month was filled with something going on, because that's how I do things, is overboard, you know. So if I'm the hostess, and I have to be at all these events, I was out drinking every night of the week. And I considered that social drinking because I was being social when I drank. I ended up meeting a fellow who didn't drink. And he would come to happy hour on Friday night. And he usually showed up about 10 o'clock or so. And he had told me that he was into real estate development. And he was, you know, a wheelie dealer kind of guy. And so I just assumed that he said he had a meeting. So I just assumed that he was doing some sort of real estate deal. Why on a Friday night, I didn't know, but I figured people work for a living, they, you know, do these things on the side. And I was intrigued by the fact that he didn't drink. He's like, thank God, because I used to date drunks. Every guy I ever dated was either a drug addict, an alcoholic, or just plain crazy. And having a guy who didn't drink was such a refreshing thing. But, of course, that didn't change my behavior. You know, just because he chooses to drink, it's none of my business. But at least I had a designated driver. So all of a sudden, I'm dating this guy, you know, very short period of time. But he comes to happy hour one night, and he was absolutely livid, with just steam coming out of his ears. And I come to find out, he had been to his AA meeting. And he had gone to pick up his one-month chip or his three-month chip or something. And he had gotten talking to one of the guys outside the meeting about a party he'd been to where he'd smoked a little pot and was talking about how great it was and blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out that was the guy giving out the chips. And when he went to pick up his chip, the guy said, "Man, I'm sorry, but I can't give you this. Our program is one of recovery from alcohol and all mood-altering substances, and you told me about the pot. I can't give you this." So he came to happy hour steaming. And it's the first I heard that he was an alcoholic. And the second was I thought he was going to drink that night, and he didn't. And that really registered with me. Now, all of a sudden, though, it did change my drinking because and that's one thing if you just choose not to drink, and I do, and that's fine, you know, whatever. But if all of a sudden you're not drinking because it's a problem for you, then maybe I need to be careful. And certainly making you go buy me drinks is pretty rude, right? So I decided that I was not going to make him. But then I was like, well, it's not my problem. It's his problem. So I just won't make him buy me more than two. That's what I'm thinking. Now, I know somewhere in my head I was thinking I was only going to drink two. But I think what I said, or at least what I rationalized later, was I'm only going to make him buy me two. I started buying the rest myself. I was getting them from friends, the bartenders I knew very well, because I was bringing all these people to their bar. I was getting free drinks, and I would get loaded. And I think he remembered that because, well, that's another part of the story. But he remembered that I was drinking to excess. Very shortly after that, we ended up not seeing each other. Then I found out I was pregnant. So I had to track him down and let him know that he was going to be a father. And I had this attitude at the time, and I tend to still do, that it doesn't seem fair that women have all the choice. You know, if I want an abortion and it's your baby and you want a child, that's not fair to you if I go have, you know. And so I had this idea that I couldn't give him the choice of whether to have the child or not because I was having this kid. But I needed to give him some sort of choice. I just felt like it wasn't fair. So I gave him the choice of being involved or not involved, and he chose not to be involved. So that was the end of that. Went ahead, had the baby. And somewhere, God has a sense of humor. The two women that I got as babysitters for when my daughter was first born, one was in AA and one was in Al-Anon. And I'd come back from work to pick her up, and I'd be, you know, moaning and groaning while they were getting my daughter ready. I'm sitting there giving them my sob story about life in general. And finally, one of them says to me, "I have a book you should read," and gave me the book, Women Who Love Too Much. And it's all about codependency. It's about Melody Beatty. And I read that book, and I devoured it. And I saw myself in that book. My father was the alcoholic in my family. And I am clearly, because of anybody who, you know, the textbook case, child of an alcoholic, is right here standing in front of you. And so I saw all that. I didn't see any of my own alcoholism, but I saw that I was child of an alcoholic, and I started going to Al-Anon. So I started in Al-Anon in August of 1986. And in October of 86, my daughter's father came out of treatment. He had been in a 90-day treatment program. He was so screwed up. And he got out of treatment, and I guess his sponsor had told him that he probably should find out if he really did have a child somewhere. And so he looked me up, and we got talking, and I happened to live around the corner from his parents, and he mentioned he was going to be at his parents' house. So I said, "Well, you should stop by. You get to meet Melissa." He says, "Who's that, your new roommate?" I said, "Kind of. It's your daughter." "Oh, yeah, I heard you had a child, a baby some time ago." You know, that's how clueless he was. So he came by, and he had just getting out of treatment. He was very up to here with all of his excitement about the program. And he had the Jelinek chart, and he had all his notes from treatment. And he's I know he remembered my drinking. Now, he doesn't remember a whole lot about our dating relationship because he tells me today that it's like a blank because he was so screwed up himself on his drugs. But he did remember that I had a drinking problem. And so he came by to 12-step me. And we have never dated since. That wasn't the point of him coming by, and it wasn't my reason for staying involved with him. But I started thinking, well, maybe I'm going to get this father for my kid that, you know, she really needs if I keep this relationship going. So, you know, I welcomed him to the house and, you know, listened to his spiel about the Jelinek chart and all about alcoholism and, like, in one ear and out the other. But then he invited me to go to a meeting that night. Well, Al-Anon tells you you should go to open AA meetings and hear the speakers and, you know, so you can understand you're an alcoholic. So I said yes. And so we took my daughter with us because I didn't have a babysitter and got to that. My very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting was in Fairfax, Virginia on October 18th, 1986. And we were late. So I didn't get to the, you know, when they say, is this anyone here for their first meeting? I did not respond because I wasn't there. After that, every time they asked that at any meeting I went to, I never responded because that wasn't my first meeting. You know, so I never had the opportunity to say, you know, introduce myself. But that night I heard two speakers and they told my story. Now, I couldn't relate to the ending of their story, but I could relate entirely to the beginning. And this was where the denial started to break down for me, was that first meeting. I could sit there and listen to them talking about their early stage of drinking. And I said, I did that. I did that. Oh, my God, I did that too. And then when they got into the drunkalogue, the part where they were getting the DUIs and losing jobs, oh, well, that's not me. And so it was easy for me to say, I'm not one of you. But it was very clear that I was on the road to becoming an alcoholic, and I was going to stop before I got there. And I think I broke my arm, patting myself on the back for all of my good fortune in, you know, smart thinking of quitting drinking before I became an alcoholic. So I started going to Al-Anon meetings and AA meetings from that point on. I stuck to open AA meetings. We went, we were living in Northern Virginia, and Sandy Beach was doing his step study on Saturday mornings, the Saturday night, Saturday morning, whatever it was called. And so I learned my steps that way. I was still working with my Al-Anon sponsor, and working through the Al-Anon workbooks and step books and stuff. And little by little, I was hearing things that, you know, if you go to enough meetings, you hear your story. And if you're, eventually the walls break down. And especially when you come in thinking that you belong in Al-Anon, and I'm just being wonderful and visiting you, you know, and I love your stories. And I always loved alcoholics anyway. And so, you know, what a great place to meet people that are my kind of people. But I didn't see that I was already there until I was 5.5 months sober. I didn't drink after that very first meeting. I was like, I'm not raising my daughter in the kind of household that I was raised in. So I'm going to quit drinking before I become one of you. And so that I quit. And it wasn't a problem for me at first. I found other food, among other things. You know, you could substitute all kinds of things that don't get you arrested. But I was going to meetings, and I was actually working my steps in Al-Anon, and it was through some of my step work in Al-Anon that some of that denial broke down as well. When I had to start writing a history of, you know, my experience with alcohol as a child of an alcoholic and then as a user of alcohol, and how my relationships affected me and what types of relationships, and that's when I started really seeing all the alcoholics in my life. And it also dawned on me somewhere in there that one of the reasons that I didn't think I was an alcoholic is because all the other people around me drank more than I did. Well, at least it seemed like they did. So they were the alcoholics, but not me. Well, interestingly enough, after I got sober, half of them showed up in AA too. They followed me in, and they're still sober today too. It's neat. The real kicker was when one of the guys that had been a roommate of mine called me up and said, are you still going to those meetings? And I said, yeah. He says, I just got a DUI and I lost my license. Can I ride with you? So I started picking him up. He didn't live very far from me, so I started taking him to meetings. Sometimes I'd drop him off at the AA meeting and I'd go to Al-Anon. Sometimes it would be an open meeting that I'd stay for. But either way, you know, we were going to the meetings together. And one Friday night, now I'm still active in the singles group, incidentally. And one Friday night, we were on our way to a meeting. I was supposed to pick him up, and I was late. I was always late. And I called him to say I was running late. He said, never mind, I got a different ride. You know, I'll see you there. And immediately, I'm sitting at a stop sign or a traffic light, I can't remember which, and I was just sitting there, and I'm realizing that if I go this way to the meeting, that's where the meeting is. But if I turn this way, happy hour, right down the road. And something in me knew that if I went to happy hour, I would drink. And I sat there, and I just, it felt like the angel and the devil sitting on my shoulders fighting it out in my head. And I started crying. I just knew that if I went to the happy hour, I would drink. And if I drank, that proved I was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to be one. And all I had to do to not be one is to not drink. And so the pull and the desire to go to the happy hour was so strong that it was tearing me up. And I sat there, I don't know how long until somebody finally beeped behind me and I knew I had to move. And I said a quick prayer and I turned left. Now, the next thing was I was late for the meeting, and by this time so late that I knew, and I didn't like walking into meetings late. But up in Northern Virginia, there's meetings on every corner, you know, in every church. So I'm driving in and out of church parking lots looking for bumper stickers or smokers, you know, outside. And I found a meeting, and I walked in, and I will never forget, I hope I never forget, the topic that night. It was not a beginner's meeting. I used to always just go to the open meetings or the beginner's meetings. I don't even know if this was even open. Again, I was still a few minutes late, so I didn't have to answer anybody. But the topic was doing whatever it takes. And I remember that the guy who brought up the topic was newly sober and working three or four jobs to try and make ends meet so that he could pay off all the debt that he'd gotten up to his eyeballs in from drinking. And he was missing meetings and he was shaky. And everybody in the meeting said, if you have to quit every one of those jobs, you do that and you get your fanny to meetings. And that has stayed with me. And that was an important lesson that I needed to learn. I still was not out of my denial, though. But a couple of other things happened. Paul, my daughter's father, took me to a meeting in somewhere around Leesburg. It was called the Blue Ridge Club, and it was a church. Some of you have been there. It was a church that used to be a church and now was a club room. And they had a wonderful breakfast meeting. And so he took me to that. Now, remember, I never had to say I'm at my first meeting. And I always made it sure to go to open meetings. Well, we get to this meeting, and the first thing they ask is anyone here at the Blue Ridge Club for the first time? I didn't think anything of it. Raise my hand. Well, then they start going around the room, and every single person who had raised their hand was an alcoholic. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, I'm in a closed meeting. What do I do now? And we're out in the middle of nowhere, you know, and I didn't drive. And so I'm starting to think, oh, my God, they're going to throw me out. Now, I've been sober for about 5 months at that time. And so that whole tradition of, you know, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking really kept running through my head. It's like, they can't throw me out because I'm sober today. And what do I say when they get to me? What do I say? And I can't say I'm an alcoholic because if I do, Paul will throw me in treatment. He'd already done that to two of my friends that were my drinking buddies, and he'd sent them off with their boyfriends and convinced them to go to treatment. So I couldn't do that. Even 5 months sober, he would have put me in treatment, and I have a new baby at home, right? So I can't do that. But then I don't want to lie and say, well, I'm in Al-Anon, because then if it's a closed meeting, they might, you know, want to try and then I got to get all defensive. And I just got so screwed up. You know that squirrel cage? It was spinning hard. And I ended up busying myself with my daughter so that they went past me and I didn't speak up. But that squirrel cage would not stop. And for the next week, I could not stop thinking, maybe really I am an alcoholic. Maybe I really, you know, what if I am? And a friend of mine, the girl that was my roommate when I first got sober and one of the ones that Paul had gotten into treatment, had come out and she and I had been friends for a while but hadn't talked as often. And she called me one day and she goes, you never talk anymore. She says, you know, what's going on with you? And she says, why don't you ever talk to me about what's going on? And I'm like, you know, well, let me just tell you what, here's what's going on. And I said, told her I thought I might be an alcoholic. Well, she snorted, and she goes, you're not an alcoholic. And I was so mad at her, I thought, how do you know? You were always drunk and passed out before I was. I'm the one putting you to bed. You know, and then I just got so angry with her, I hung up on her. And my first thought then was, I'm going to go out and get drunk and show you. And then I thought, oh, my God, if that is an alcoholic thinking, I don't know what is. So that squirrel cage started going again. And so the next thing I did was I stopped and talked to the babysitters, you know, the AA and the Al-Anon babysitters. And I'm saying, you know, I think I might have a problem with the drinking. I'm starting to hear more of my story. And just because I didn't get a DUI doesn't mean I'm not an alcoholic. Just because I never got, you know, arrested or, you know, fired doesn't mean I'm not an alcoholic. And so they suggested that I do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, yeah, I can't do that. I got a new baby. You going to babysit? They said, no. And so I said, well, what next? And they said, well, get to as many meetings as you can. And in the meantime, you're pretty good at procrastinating. Why don't you just procrastinate that next drink until you figure it out? And that has worked for me for 25 years. Because I still go back and forth sometimes. I have these moments when I think I've overreacted. And I think that's part of the nature of the beast. You know, we don't, our bodies, our minds want to drink. And so any excuse will do. And even after years of sobriety, I find myself, if I'm not in a fit spiritual condition, I start thinking that maybe I overreacted. And I'll tell you one of those stories in a minute. So here I am with this trying to get to as many meetings as I can, dealing with, you know, taking my daughter when I can to meetings. Some meetings were really good about letting her come, and other meetings it was pretty clear that people were uncomfortable having a baby in the room because if she started to fuss a little bit and I'd have to get up, it was distracting. And I had to respect the sobriety of the other people, and some of them were new and as screwed up as I was and needed to be able to hear, and if my kid's crying, they can't hear. So I had to pick and choose my meetings. I finally ended up finding some other women with children, and we started taking turns, watching each other's kids. And then a wonderful thing happened. I was in Northern Virginia, and a church in my community called an intergroup office and said, we would like to have an AA meeting at our church. As it turned out, they had a member of their church who was a drunk, and they wanted him to get sober, and they thought by bringing the meeting to the church that he'd show up at the meetings, but of course he never did. It was too close to home for him. But what we did, my current sponsor was the intergroup office manager at the time, and she knew me as a friend and for meetings, and she called me and she said, if you would contact this church, you know, and see if they'll let you have babysitting, that might help. So I did, and they agreed to let us use their nursery. So we finally had a meeting that had babysitting, and we took turns watching the kids. And then finally, somebody who had a 12-year-old brought their daughter, and we paid her $1 a kid to watch the kids during the meeting. And so I was able to get to more meetings. The other thing that happened then was I went to Florida to visit my mother, and so I had a built-in babysitter there, and I started to go to 2 or 3 meetings a day. And I went to a women's meeting in Clearwater, Florida, where the speaker told my story. She had never had a DUI. She never had gotten fired from a job. She had all of the things that she didn't have any of the things that I didn't, you know, the same kind of idea. But she knew because of how she felt inside and that she really was an alcoholic. And I felt safe in saying, yes, I am one. I didn't have to have all those badges of honor, that sometimes we call it, to believe. And so I picked up my white chip that night, and then I came back home, and 2 weeks later picked up my 6-month chip. And I've had a pretty easy time of it, considering how many people I see come and go. I'm fortunate that from that day in October 18th, 1986, I have not found it necessary to pick up a drink. But as I said before, I've thought about it. I've certainly thought about it. When I was 20 years sober, I was chairing the state convention that we had in Waynesboro back in 07. And I was the public information committee chair for the area, and I was rotating out of that and onto the convention chair position. I was sponsoring 5 women. I was going to meetings regularly. My daughter was a college kid by that time, so I had no limits on going to meetings at night. So I was going to plenty of meetings, and up to my eyeballs in service. And I had gone to an event in Richmond that the Buckingham Group sponsors every year in February. And there were, I was with three other AAs, and we all got a hotel room. Two of them were like 1 month and 2 months sober, and the other one was married with a couple kids and was away from home for the first time in a while. And we were staying at a hotel where there was a Calypso bar next door, and she's Puerto Rican or Guatemalan or something, and she wanted to go dancing. And I'm sitting, first of all, during the day, I'm in this conference, and I don't know if you guys know is it Bob D and yeah, they were the speakers, and they were pounding, standing up the podium, pounding on the big book says this, and the big book says that, and the real alcoholic this, and the real alcoholic that. And they read that part in here about the real alcoholic and that description. And I'm sitting there with 150 AAs around me, up to my eyeballs in service and program, and I'm going, well, I'm not a real alcoholic. That's not me. I must have overreacted. and I'm here to tell you, I started crying. Because then my thoughts went like this. Okay, if I'm not really an alcoholic, then I guess I don't have to be here. Well, if I don't come to meetings anymore and I start drinking, then all my friends are going to stop hanging out with me. Or the only time they're going to talk to me is to try and 12-step me back in the rooms, and I don't need to be here. And then I'm starting to cry because it's like, how pathetic am I that I have to pretend to be an alcoholic just so people will like me? That's where it took me. And I couldn't stop crying. I had to leave the room. It was horrible. And I finally got myself pulled together enough, and we all went out to dinner, and I'm being quiet for a change, and everybody's kind of, you know, being silly and having fun. And we get back to the hotel room, and this one gal wants to go dancing. And I'm like, no, we can't go to the bar. And she said, well, she assumed it was because we had the two newcomers with us. And, of course, I use that as an excuse, too. But she said, oh, no, they're with us. We won't let them drink. And I'm like, honey, you won't be able to stop me. If you take me to, and finally I had to say that to her. I said, if you take me to that bar, I will drink. And you will be sorry, and so will I. And I don't want to do that. I said, please don't push it. And, you know, they looked at me like I had three heads. And then one of them said to me, oh, Rosie, we love you. You're so honest and you're so funny. And they really didn't take me seriously. But we didn't go to the bar. And that night I called my sponsor, couldn't get a hold of her, but I went back home and I got a hold of her and we talked it out. The other thing that was going on at the time that was very helpful was we had a gal who moved to our area who was a speaker at my home group one Sunday morning. And she had a phrase that she used where she was talking about being taken through the big book. And just the way she described, you know, what she was saying, it was like, I understand the words she's saying and I know what she means by that, but I didn't understand how did that work for you? And so I went up to her afterwards and I said, I don't think I've ever been sponsored that way. And in fact, I had not. After learning more about what she was talking about, I had never been sponsored that way. First of all, I've been through 20 sponsors in 20 years, I think, because they move away. And Northern Virginia was a very influx place. Either they let me go, I let them go, they moved, you know, different reasons. I went for a period of time where I had a long distance sponsor. I never went through all 12 steps with one person. I'd been through all the 12 steps, but not always with one person. And we'd always, you know, I'd start with one, go through one through three, then I'd do four, five, and six with somebody else, and, you know, that kind of thing. So the way she described it, it just appealed to me, and I asked her if she would take me through it. Well, she only had 10 years of sobriety, and I had 20. It wasn't a matter of who has what time, but she had something I wanted. And so she had started, I think, in November, and this was in February. So we were going through very painstakingly. We were reading the big book from the cover to cover. Well, we didn't do the stories, but we read the first 164 pages, starting from the foreword to the first edition. And we would read it together for about 45 minutes on the phone every week. And we would talk about what we were reading. And at the time I got back from this conference in Richmond, we were still working heavily on step one. and I shared with her what I was going through, and we went back and reviewed some of the stuff that we had covered. And she also, it was between her and my sponsor, we really helped me get back to step one, and that whole idea of powerlessness and the surrender. And it was extremely powerful for me. Sometimes we have to go through those things in order to get regrounded. Because I was telling Cindy on the way up here, you know, you get through, she just turned me on to a new book that it's called Drop the Rock, and it's basically on steps 6 and 7. And it start. I've only just got it, so I've only just read the forward and the first little bit of it. But it talks about how periodically in our sobriety we get flat. You know, it's things get stagnant. We're doing service and we're showing up at meetings and stuff, but somehow the life, the fun, the newness, the freshness is not there. And, you know, we're just kind of going through the motions. And in a way, that's where I've been lately. I'm going through some major changes, and my employment is changing. My daughter's broken engagement, moved back home. Now she's moving back out. You know, there's a lot of screwy things going on. I just bought a house. So I'm letting those things distract me, and I haven't been working as solidly on my step work and my internal journaling and some of the tools that have always worked for me. I've just been kind of flatlined, and that's happened to me, on, you know, more than once in sobriety. And it's wonderful to, and I think it's the reason that I get to stay involved in service, especially sponsoring others. When I sponsor someone else, I have to go back through the steps with them, so I'm kind of going through them with me. And what I've taken to doing in the last few years is actually not just taking them through it, but working them at with them, alongside them. And so I've been doing more step work. And lately, it seems like all the women I sponsor right now seem to be in double-digit sobriety. And I don't really have many newcomers. I have one newcomer. But she's a repeat, so she had several years of sobriety at one time. So it's not like I'm taking somebody fresh and teaching them stuff. So it's kind of easy to slack off with things and to kind of take it slow. So it's timely that this this step 6 and 7 is coming up for me and looking at a little more work. And I'm very, very grateful that in the times that I have been, you know, a little flaky, and especially in the times like that incident in Richmond when I'm really flaky, that I've got a lot of sobriety around me and that there are people that I go to. I had a sponsor one time tell me that I didn't really need an AA sponsor, a step sponsor. She said, you need a service sponsor because you're so involved in service. So I ended up getting a woman to be my service sponsor, and went through a period of time without an AA sponsor, but I found myself using the service sponsor as an AA sponsor, so eventually she became both. What this woman had told me at that time was that I already had an innate sense that when I was, you know, getting a little squirrely, I made the phone calls, and I always had a lot of women's phone numbers to call, and I never hesitated to call them when I got squirrely. And I think that's been a real key to my sobriety, is having the number of women in my life that have strong program and strong support that they can tell me when I need to hear when I call, and I'm not afraid to call them. That's the there are times when the phone weighs 500 pounds, But I have enough common sense, thank God, or enough grace from God to know to pick up the phone and call if I'm in a bad place. So, but one of the things that was really odd to me is, like I said, when I first came in, I did not think I was an alcoholic. I just thought I was a social drinker. But as I got more sober and I made some connections and started doing some 9-step work, I got reconnected to some of my old friends and some old relationships from when I was drinking. And there was this one woman who had been my best friend since 9th grade. We'd been roommates on more than one occasion. We had a very tumultuous relationship. She was difficult at best, and I was tolerant. and I got to a point where I ended up having to end that relationship because, as it turned out, she was abusive to me, and I never saw it. I was so tolerant. But what happened when I first got connected back to her to make my amends, because she was my roommate when I was, you know, some of my craziest drinking, I started having memory bubbles come up, and some of my craziest drinking occurred in Louisville, Kentucky. She was my roommate, and so I was calling to try and, you know, make an amend to her for my all of the years of abuse, you know, whatever I'd done to her, trying to figure out what it was. And she made a comment that really, really struck me odd, and then I understood where it was. She says there was no reason at that time for me to think that she would be lying to me. She had no reason to do so. But she said to me, you know, your neighbors were so glad when I moved in with you. And I thought that was odd because I knew the neighbors didn't like her. I just knew that. And so I'm like, well, why do you say that? And she said, because before I moved in, she said, they had to put you to bed all the time. Now, we had this apartment. It was like the stairwell and then two apartments upstairs, and they were in one and I was in the other. And then there was a door at the bottom of the stairs, and they would come home, and my dog would be running up and down the stairs with his eyes turning yellow because he had to go out. And I would be passed out on the floor of my living room with my door wide open. And so the husband would take the dog out while she would put me to bed, and she would throw pajamas on me or a nightgown or something and tuck me in. And all I knew was I woke up in the morning and I was in bed. The dog was fine. You know, what's the problem? But in fact, I'd been in a blackout. And I had been having blackouts for quite a period of time, and I did not know that. Because if you're in a blackout and you wake up where you belong, how do you know you were in one? It's different if you're in a blackout in Kansas City and you wake up in Schenectady, New York, and you don't know how you got there. There's, you know, well, maybe something happened to you, honey. But, you know, if you're where you belong and every night was the same as the night before, you went to the bar, you went, had a few drinks, you went out for breakfast afterwards, and you went home and went to bed. And you wake up in the morning and you're there. How would you even know? And so that's when it really started to dawn on me, I really am an alcoholic. I don't know anyone who has had blackouts that isn't one of us. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some out there. I've just never met any. But other memory bubbles were coming up at that point then, and I talked to a few other people who had known me back then. And as I said before, because so many of my friends drank more than I did, they were not always aware of my drinking because they passed out first. But then I started connecting with other people, and Facebook has been wonderful because, you know, you can connect with folks that, you know, you forgot they even existed until you saw their name somewhere. But I've come to learn that my drinking was out of control on more than one occasion, way back into my 20s. And so I think it came to a head when I lived in Louisville, Kentucky. And as I said, I was blacking out. I was drinking every night. I was doing some things that we won't go into right now because that's more fifth step stuff. But I was absolutely wild in that period of time. I had gotten into a little bit of experience with drugs when I lived in New Jersey, and I moved yet another geographic cure. I had about 12 geographic cures. You know, and lived in 9 different states. And the move to Kentucky was to get away from my New Jersey drinking and drugging. And it didn't work. It got worse. So having the clarity of, you know, what do they call it, 20/20 vision. In hindsight, it's always 20/20. I started to see some of the crazy things that I did and some of the hurtful things that I did. And among them, I actually had gotten fired indirectly because of my drinking. When I first divorced my first husband, I was in New Jersey, and I started hanging out with a band that was the follow-up from Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen used to play at the Stone Pony in New Jersey, and the band, after he got famous and wasn't playing there regularly, the band that took his place was my bar band. And I was at the Stone Pony every night, and I started dating the road manager from Springsteen's first group. And we were doing all kinds of things after hours and close the bar. And I'd do things that would keep me awake all night so that I'd get to work the next day and make it through the day. And then I'd go home and crash for 20 hours. And I couldn't afford that lifestyle. I couldn't afford it. So I started stealing from my employer. And they finally caught me. And when they caught me, they offered me a buyout they won't arrest me if I promise to pay. So I made financial arrangements, and then I lit out of town. And then I swore off the drugs because obviously that was what got me in trouble. It wasn't the drinking, right? But I got back into that a little bit. But that was something that I had to make amends for, and I ended up going back to my employer, and they were just so happy that I was in AA that they said, don't worry about it. But I did still make financial amends. And I said, I don't care what you do. I mean, they said, well, we already wrote it off. The insurance company paid for it. I said, that doesn't matter. You go make a donation to some, you know, charity or something with it then. So I don't know what they ended up doing with it. But it's been humbling to look back with the clarity of sobriety and see some of the things that I did do and here I just thought I was such a nice person, you know, I'm a nice Catholic girl, and Catholic girls don't do the things I did. So I guess the other piece that I kind of want to talk about is what it's like now is that partly because of all that behavior, which actually started when I turned about 19, 20 is when I first started drinking. 21 is when it really took off because I was legally able to go sit in the bar every night. When I started behaving that way, nice Catholic girls don't do that. So I chose not to be Catholic. I also chose not to go to any other church, and therefore there was no God. And I had the only relationship that I had with God was the whole foxhole prayer, you know, help me out, get out of this and I won't do it again kind of thing. Or I was convinced that he was evil, hateful, judgmental, and all of those negative things that I was actually doing to myself. It wasn't God telling me all this stuff, it was me, because I wasn't meeting my own expectations. I struggled back and forth over the years, like when I got pregnant and I wanted my daughter to be baptized, I went back to the Catholic Church to see, you know, if they would, and so I had to be Catholic again or they wouldn't baptize her, so I started going to church, and then as soon as that was done, we went back to our old behavior again, and, you know, but today, and I still struggle with the whole church thing, but I do have a God in my life today that is now a loving and caring and supportive God of my understanding. And because I still am somewhat schizophrenic about God and church, and I don't, my higher power is not necessarily the God of my childhood. And in fact, it's probably not even remotely close now that I think about it. But I get really confused about how to describe it, and I'm so grateful that AA doesn't expect me to. It is my understanding, or as some people say, the God of my misunderstanding, the God of my lack of understanding. And I think that if the higher power I have is as all-powerful and all-wonderful as I want him to be and need him to be, then there's no way my measly little human brain can get my head around it anyway. So why bother? So I try not to even go there a lot. All I need to know is that there is a God, and I'm not it, and the one that I do have loves me and wants me to be happy and has some suggestions for me to keep me on a path that will help me be there. And so that's what I try to do today is stay in touch in some way or another with that higher power. And I tend to, sometimes I use the word God, you know, after a while it just kind of runs together, but I actually consciously think of HP and God as two separate entities for convenience and to keep me sane. And I have a little plaque that one of my old sponsors, needlepoint for me. It says HP lives here. And I have that on my dresser at home. And it's my constant reminder that there is a higher power in my life that I choose to use and sometimes call HP, sometimes call God, sometimes call him Bozo because I'm frustrated. But I know it's there, and I know that it wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And that part of what I need to do to be there and to follow that path is to show up and participate in AA meetings, to go to work every day when I'm supposed to go to work, to make phone calls, to reach out, to help other people, and to stay active in things other than this little neighborhood up here. Because that's what they say, it's a bad neighborhood to play in, a dangerous place to go. Anyway, I sometimes go back to church because I've come to understand that while I don't think, and I hope there's nobody that's heavy-duty Catholic here to get mad at me, I'm not sure that I buy all of the things that the church says, but I'm more Catholic than I am anything else. I went through, when I was doing my 11th step, I must have gone to 40 different churches in Northern Virginia. And when I moved down I actually moved to Lexington from Northern Virginia, and I had all this mail with yellow stickers on it. It was being forwarded from every church in Northern Virginia because I'd signed the guest book, you know, and all the mail got forwarded. But I did. I tried the synagogue. I tried Presbyterian, Methodist, all the different ones. And I kept going back to, you know, I'm not a very good Catholic, but I'm a better Catholic than anything else. So I do try to go back. To when I go to church, I do that. But my real Sunday morning worship, if you will, is my home group, and that meets on Sunday morning at the Augusta Health Community Care Building in Fishersville. So anybody that's around on a weekend, come visit us. Cindy and I both attend that meeting regularly, and it is my home group, and that's my Sunday morning regular place to be. The relationship that I have with God today is that I talk to Him on a regular basis, several times during the day. I don't just do it in the morning or at night. In fact, I still struggle with the whole formalized morning and evening routines because my days just don't always work that way. But I am always, when I'm driving and I spend a lot of time in my car, I'm praying while I drive. I turn the radio off and I just pray. I ask for guidance whenever I have a decision that needs to be made. Whenever I'm working with a sponsee, before we have our conversation, I usually will say a quick prayer saying, God, help me help them, instead of, and get me out of the way. Because I have such an ego and such a self-centered, you know, it's all about me that, you know, somebody starts telling me their problems, the first thing I want to do is relate it to one of my experiences, you know, and that's not always as helpful to them. And I struggle with that. I'm still very self-absorbed and very self-centered. And so I have to work at being otherwise. But I'm willing to work at it today. So I've had health issues. An example of how the serenity that this relationship with God and the comfort and conviction that God's wanting me to be happy and okay, everything's going to work out. I heard recently, this was great. It's all going to work out in the end. And if it's not looking good right now, it's because it isn't the end. And I love that. Sometimes you're in the middle of the path and you're not there yet. So you've got to be patient, and that's hard for us. But for me, the conviction that I am okay, regardless of whatever the circumstances, I'm losing my job at the end of October. I'm okay with that. I'll find something to do. You know, I'll either retire, work part-time, or get another job. You know, it's no big deal. I'm not freaking out over it. But I got to tell you an example of how it used to be and how it is now. Back when I was drinking, and I worked at the Smithsonian, which was really fun, and the guy I was dating also worked there, and we used to go, he was in the budget office, I was in the accounting office, and so everything that they did that involved an opening of an exhibit, they invited all the people who participated on putting it together. So the budget office and the accounting office were fundamental to that. We always got invited to all these black tie affairs. So my whole dating relationship with this guy was getting all dolled up in evening attire and attending every weekend some kind of an opening at the Smithsonian with all the free booze. And we ended up breaking up. And I found out I had some medical stuff going on, and I called the doctor for the results on the test, and he had told me that he thought it might be precancerous, and that if it was what he thought it was, I was going to have some surgery. It was a minor surgery. It was not a big, but I, you know, all I heard was cancer and surgery. And when I called for the exam results, he said, oh, I'm afraid it was what I thought it was. Do you want me to make you an appointment for the surgery? And I'm like, well, yeah. And he transferred me quick to the nurse, and I didn't get to ask him all the questions I had. So here I am. I'm dying of cancer. I met with the guy, the boyfriend, and I said, you know, it's a good thing we broke up because I'm dying of cancer. Well, 3 years ago, I had some other surgery, and they found cancer. And I didn't freak out over it. I think at 2 o'clock in the morning when I was in pain and they hadn't brought my pain meds, I did have a little meltdown and the nurse came in and prayed with me. But other than that, I have had this ongoing come back and go away, come back, had chemo, cancer, that is not as life-threatening as it sounds. I mean, there's an awful lot of cancers out there that are really not a big deal, that, you know, you just go every 6 months for a checkup, and then if they catch it, they take it out, and you're good for another 6 months. And that's the kind I have. But, I mean, it is far more serious than what I had 25, 30 years ago, and yet I'm okay with it. You know, it's like I'm okay with it. I really am. I go next week for a follow-up to see how I'm doing, and whether or not I have it come back, it doesn't matter. I'm still okay. And as I was teasing Cindy this morning, every day above ground is a good one, and I really believe that today. And that's because of the relationship I have with my higher power today. I know that as long as I have today sober, something good's going to happen. Something good's already happened. I'm sober today. And you are too. And I'm glad you're here for me. And I think there's a few minutes left, but I'm going to go ahead and stop now, because if I keep talking, I'll come up with something that'll take me 20 minutes. But the bottom line is that I am very, very grateful to be a recovering alcoholic. You know, that's a quick thought. I used to, you know, when somebody say, I'm grateful to be sober today, I'm like, how can you be grateful for, you know, how can you be grateful to be an alcoholic? But the truth is, this is a story I will tell you. I went to Dr. Bob's house in Akron, Ohio. I had an opportunity to do that 1 year. And I had a spiritual experience. I walked in the bedroom upstairs where he had a desk, and I sat down at the desk, and we had about 25 people in the room on this tour. And I looked around the room, and you know the pictures of Bill and Bob, the black and white? Well, there were pictures all around the walls of all the guys that wrote the stories in that first edition of the Big Book. And they all looked alike. You know, they all had their suits and their, you know, shaven heads and, you know, short hair. And I looked at them and I thought, my dad would have, they looked like his buddies. They looked like him and his buddies. And I thought, he would have loved this program. He was a sociable guy. He would have been the one greeting at everybody at the door. He'd have been speaking every other week. I mean, you know, he would have loved the fellowship of AA. And I kind of went into what my sponsor called the place in my heart that's walled up. And I went there. And I call it a sober blackout. I zoned out. I remember nothing. I was just gone. I was somewhere in here. But when I came to, I was so embarrassed because my face was soaking wet and my shirt was soaking wet. I'd been crying to the point where I was just snot and tears just soaking me. And I was humiliated until I looked around the room and I saw that everyone else in the room had the same face and the same wet shirts. Something had happened to all of us that day. But for me, what I came out of it was, my dad had an opportunity to go to AA. He actually had a month of sobriety, and he went to a meeting, and another guy that got sober the same day he did went out to celebrate after the meeting and went and had a drink, and he never made it back to AA. I have been given the same gift that my father was given, but I chose to keep it. And for that, I am extraordinarily grateful. And if I were not an alcoholic, I wouldn't have this. And this has changed my life in such a wonderful way that I wouldn't give it up for anything. So I'm extremely grateful. And, you know, on those days when I start thinking, well, maybe I overreacted, it's like, that's okay. We won't tell anyone. I still want to come. I still want to be here. I want to be one of you. And I'm very grateful to be here. Thanks.